Thank you.
My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not an expert on alcoholism. I'm also an adult husband of an Al-Anon member. And we're a small but growing 12-step program that deals with the devastating effects of living with a partner who's been conscious throughout our entire relationship. I'm really delighted to have been asked. I want to thank the committee, particularly Chris and Frank, for asking me to be here. It's really neat. I mean, there was a fruit plate in my room and select vision and everything. It was just great. Dances with Wolves you can watch as many times as you want. Did you know that? Isn't that great? I love Dances with Wolves. My Indian name is Pukes on Christmas Trees. They called me months ago to be here in Palm Springs, and Palm Springs is a real big deal for me, you know. So I really, really worked very hard to lose 35 pounds, and you know, look great. I started last week, and I got sober in Southern California. And I moved to Vancouver, British Columbia 3 years ago, and this is the first time I've been back, and I assumed it was because you knew me. Nobody's ever asked me before to come back and share in Southern California. And I bring greetings from Vancouver. It rains a lot there. It's really neat to have 2 days in a row where the sun shines. It's just amazing. I got sober in Southern California because I had to. It was the last house on the block. I was out of ideas by the time I got here. And it was a long way before I got here, got to the time that I had to get sober. I was raised in Canada, and I was uncomfortable all my life. My emotions seemed to be kind of out of control, and I didn't fit anywhere. And I was tall, and I was fat, and had thick glasses and crooked teeth, and I was 14 years old, and I was uncomfortable. And then I found comfort. Southern comfort is what I found. And I loved it from the get-go. I loved the way it felt going down, and I didn't mind the way it felt coming up either. A magic thing happened for me that night. I found a way to be alive and dead at the same time, and it's what I always wanted to be. I always wanted to be in the center of things. I just didn't want to feel anything, and alcohol afforded that for me right off the get-go. Later on, as the disease progressed, I wanted to be dead. I just didn't want to die to do it, you know. And I managed it quite handily. By the time I arrived here in Alcoholics Anonymous, emotions were something that I had none of. I had attitudes and I had defenses, but I didn't have any emotions. And when you took away my alcohol and drugs, it all kind of crashed out. And I was one of the last batches of newcomers you gave half a cup of coffee to, because I was coming off a lot of stuff when I got sober, and I was a little quick. Clara, who you'll hear tomorrow morning, Claire and I got sober together. She was an Indian princess when she got sober, and they were just nice to me because they thought I was going to come apart at any second. Nobody raised their voice above a whisper around me because they knew that I was a real fragile ground. But that first night that I got drunk, I could talk to you, and I could dance with you, I could do God knows what with you, and I did. And I came to hours later throwing up under a bush somewhere, and I could hardly wait to do it again. And I did that from then on. By the time I was 18 years old, I'd been taking drugs for a year, and I'd been drinking for 4 years, and I was in trouble with the chemicals, but the prospect of living without them was even more terrifying. And that's alcoholism. And I declared myself an alcoholic when I was 18 years old, and I didn't know that I had done it. But I said the phrase that only an alcoholic says, and if you're not sure if you belong here, and if you've said this phrase, you belong here, If you've ever heard anybody say it, you're looking at a drunk, and that phrase is, I can control my drinking. Only an alcoholic says, I can control my drinking. Social drinkers never deal with the concept. If social drinkers make a fool of themselves whilst drinking, they stop drinking. Have you ever noticed that? Isn't that odd? But from that point on, I started the great obsession of the abnormal drinker. I started to attempt to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't know if anybody in this room ever got that equation together. I would love to talk to them because I never did. I never got control and enjoy together. When I was controlling my drinking, I was not enjoying it. It was grisly, you know. And when I was the only way I enjoyed drinking was when it was wildly out of control. I thought controlled drinking was you drink all you can and try to control yourself. That's it. And I never heard the term social drinking until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought social drinking meant you got home before you passed out. If you didn't wake up in somebody's bathtub, it was social drinking. And that's the way I drank. I mean, the reason I'm standing here tonight is that I loved it. You know, make no mistake about it. I love getting loaded. I love getting blasted, smashed, boxed, bombed, ripped to the tits. I loved it. Everything about it. I just loved it. When I was not drinking, I felt like the victim of a shark attack. I felt like there were chunks of me missing. The thing about drinking was that it always worked for me. It worked from the first moment that I drank to the last drunk. There was always a time when it in a drunk where it all went together. You know, where I was sexy but romantic and cruel but charming. You know, elegant with a common touch. You know, and there was always it always happened to me. I always had that illusion of it. As I went on, the moment got shorter and shorter and shorter, and the price that I paid for it was higher and higher and higher, but it always happened, you know. The worst of my getting drunk, even if it didn't make me feel better, it made me feel less worse. You know? And that's why I did it. That's why I did it all the time. If there wasn't a payoff in it, I would have stopped doing it. I'm not stupid. You know? By the time I was 20 years old, I decided that the insides were not going to get any better. Because I had stopped asking questions. I'd figured out that if you ask questions, people found out you were in trouble. And if they found out you were in trouble, they'd pass on you. They'd just ignore you. So I started making up answers. And my solutions have always been worse than my problems. And just never let them know what's going on. Just never let them know. And you get horribly isolated and you get terribly frightened. And I decided, well, I got to work on the outsides. Now, there wasn't much hope. I was tall, I was fat, I had thick glasses, crooked teeth, and I was weird. But it's amazing how far a little alcoholic self-will can get you. First of all, I was chewing a lot of amphetamine, so you tend to drop a lot of tonnage, you know. Who wants to shut up long enough to eat lunch? And the reason I did that was not because I was particularly interested in those kind of chemicals. What I found out was that I was a really lousy drinker. I got very drunk very fast and very little, but when I dropped those diet pills, I could stay up all night and drink them all, you know, under the table. So I loved that. So anyway, I dropped some tonnage, and I got myself a job, and I got myself a pair of contact lenses, and I got my teeth capped, and shazam, I was good looking. And I liked that. I liked that. You know, a lot of people started paying attention to me. And one of the things that they noticed was that after I'd had a couple of drinks, I was capable of doing anything. So I stand before you tonight with no fantasy unlived. I have done everything that has ever occurred to me to do. I am deeply grateful that there's some things that I never thought of, but there aren't many, you know. We're getting into costumes toward the end there. And the batteries, God, it cost a lot. Anyway, I decided I was 21 years old and I had a talent that the world couldn't live without, so I went to New York and 2 months later I had my first Broadway show, and that should have fixed me. That's more than a fat, ugly kid from Victoria, British Columbia ever dreamed of doing or being. And By the time I was 24 years old, I'd done several Broadway shows, and I was going to all the right parties and balling all the right people and roaring around in limousines and living the kind of life that people think is interesting. And I was appearing every night on Broadway with a 40-piece orchestra in a pit playing a song, and I sang it with a spotlight on my face alone on a stage, and the audience, a sold-out house, applauded every night, and that should have fixed me. And I was drinking a quart of scotch a day, and I'd picked up a little non-habit-forming marijuana habit, and I was working the docks, the doctors. I love the doctors. They're such jerks. It's just perfect, you know. And there's nobody that's more arrogant and ignorant about alcoholism than a doctor. It's just perfect. What I did was I got myself a medical book and memorized some symptoms for the kind of prescriptions that I wanted. And I would go tell them about it, and they'd write the prescriptions out, and then I'd go to the other two and tell them the same story and end up with three. My favorite prescription was take as needed. I love those. Yeah, those are perfect. I think it's silly to buy drugs in alleys. You can get arrested for that sort of thing. I like nice waiting rooms and things like that. But I was 24 years old and I was in trouble with the chemicals. So I started into self-help. I went to a psychiatrist and he helped me. He got me down to a fifth of scotch a day, and he gave me a prescription for Valium and another one for Seconal. God bless that man. I don't put down psychiatrists. It's just that they're incapable of helping practicing alcoholics because we're incapable of telling the truth. You know, I told that psychiatrist exactly what I told the last arresting officer. Two beers. That's all I ever drank. Yeah, I don't know about you. Anybody in authority ask me anything. My wife has a theory that if anybody admits to drinking more than two beers, they're not an alcoholic. Yeah. I decided that what I needed was a good woman, and I found her in an elevator. We were going to rehearse a show together, and she was a little dancer. She was a little blonde dancer. She's the cutest little thing I ever saw. I saw her right off the bat. There was something in her eye that scared me. I kind of recognized that if I ever got involved with her, I'd never get uninvolved. What I didn't realize was it's that look of an Al-Anon recognizing potential. It's horrifying. It's just, you know. She didn't notice me right off the bat until 3 days later when my back went out and I crawled into rehearsal and zing went the strings of her heart. She, you know, for an Al-Anon, a drunk crawling across a hotel lobby was like coming home. She realized that I needed her. And as we got to know each other, we realized that she could do things that I couldn't do and I could do things that she couldn't do. And we kind of meshed together. We were like two crippled children trying to make one decent adult out of the two of us. We started our dance of death. We moved to California and we got married and she settled down. Now, alcoholics don't marry teetotalers. I didn't know anybody who didn't drink. I wasn't going to marry anybody who didn't drink, for God's sake, and she drank. Great-looking blonde and drank like a fish. It was just fabulous. And one night, we were having cocktails. That's what we like to call it. And she took a sip of what she was drinking and said, "This is boring." She put it down. She never drank again. And she didn't go through withdrawal or nothing. She's not an alcoholic. I mean, she just stopped drinking, and then she noticed that I drank. A lot. So what I needed to do was I needed to drink. I don't know about you, but I needed to drink. It was by that time that it had ceased to be a luxury for me. It was now a necessity, and it was medicinal. I mean, I knew that if I didn't put something to kind of buffer me against the reality of life every day, that I would go insane. I didn't think I was going to climb a tower and blow away 35 people or anything like that. You know, I thought I would probably just the stress would build up and they'd find me sitting on a park bench somewhere smiling into the sun and they'd take me someplace and they'd never bring me back. And I didn't want to do that. You know, alcohol kept me functional for a long, long time. It was diminishing returns, but there you have it. I was a blackout drinker. We used to have long talks, Bonnie and I. We used to call it Dawn Patrol. We would talk throughout the night, all our problems, and to this day I don't remember any of them. But I needed to drink, so I needed to have somebody responsible for that, and she was the closest. And so I had to keep her kind of backpedaling emotionally all the time so that she couldn't crowd me about my drinking. And, you know, if love could cure alcoholism, I wouldn't need to be here, because I've been well-loved for a long time, and I've loved her for a long time. And we've always wanted each other to be the best possible human beings we could be. We've always wanted each other to realize our full potential as human beings, and so I would help her. I would say things like, "Oh, you're going to wear that dress. You know I've always liked your hair up. I don't think you should have said that at dinner, darling. I think you upset the host." I mean, helpful stuff. So that she could be a better human being. And the clear-cut message in it was that if she was taller, if she was shorter, if she was brighter, if she wasn't so bright, if she worked, if she stayed home, if she wrote poetry, if she was a cook. I mean, if she was somehow different, I wouldn't need to drink. And the sad thing about that is that people who love alcoholics buy that, you know. And I waited for the day when she would say, "Hold it, it's not my fault. You drink." And of course she didn't do it, because the effects of alcoholism were withering her before my eyes. You know, that kind of tough, funny, feisty little dancer that I had fallen in love with was shriveling. The effects of the disease was having its toll. She was becoming, her nails were bitten to the quick, and she wouldn't get her hair done, so she wore her hair in kerchiefs all the time. She wouldn't buy new clothes. She wore kind of shapeless, kind of used clothing a lot, and her lips were disappearing. That happens to Al-Anons a lot. They're, you know, and she was angry all the time. And I used to say, "God, just relax, you know, have a Valium and a glass of wine and just cool up, you know." And if you looked at us as a couple, you'd know it was clear that she was in trouble. You know, she was a mess, and I was always kind of well dressed and well lubed, and you know, just kind of having a good time. You know, California brought a new terror to me. You know, it's amazing, as a practicing alcoholic, you assimilate terror. You just do it. It just becomes part of your personality, and you don't even notice it. I was a blackout drinker from the beginning of my drinking to the end, and now I became a driver. I'd never driven until we lived in California, and I never realized what I did behind that until I was about 5 years sober, and I was standing outside my house in the pouring rain looking for the LA Times in my bathrobe, and I said, "What am I doing here? I don't care about the news that much." And wham, it hit me what I was doing there. It was a ritual for my drinking. Every day, every morning I got up, and no matter how hungover I was, no matter how horrible I felt, I got up, put on my bathrobe, and went out to the front of the house, and then walked back up the driveway and made one quick turn around the car to see if there were any bloodstains or dents. And I did that every morning of my life, along with brushing my teeth and showering and going to work, and that horrifies me today. But it's something you do, you know, it's just something you do as a practicing alcoholic. And that's the way it was for me. That's the way it was for me. I don't have a fabulous drunkalogue, you know. I never went to death row like a regular guy in AA, you know. I just did a series of humiliating, degrading, shabby, sleazy, smarmy, slimy little things over and over and over again, interspersed with occasional spectacular achievements. And if you saw those spectacular achievements, you might have assumed that I was trying to impress you, that I was better than you, and that was never true. What was true is that I thought if I did something extraordinary, you'd think that I was equal to you. And that's where I was coming from. I was coming from so far behind, and we were at war, and I don't know why. I don't know where it started. I don't know where it was me against you. I don't know where that started. All I knew that was I had to protect myself all the time. And so I built a wall around me. And the only trouble with doing that, with building a wall that protects you from people, is it becomes a prison. And I was inside this wall that I'd built, and I became my own prisoner and my own jailer. And the prisoner was saying, "You gotta let somebody know you're in trouble, Sean." And the jailer was saying, "Don't you dare let on, because if they find out, they'll throw you away." And that's how it was for me. And the isolation and the terror. I also taking a lot of drugs. I know that some old timers don't like us to talk about that. I'm part of the '60s generation. We're the generation that made drug abuse middle class. We snatched it out of the hands of black musicians and brought it into the family rooms of America. We're the little buggers that discover medicine cabinets, and we made it simply part of our alcoholism. And to hear some of the old timers, you'd think that we messed up a perfectly respectable disease. Yeah. So hardly any of us who've come in the last 15 years are pure. You know, we have managed to taint our alcoholism with outside issues. And I don't know. A lot of the old timers seem to be annoyed about it. I think they're just kind of pissed off that they missed something. I just wonder if it, you know, I just wonder if they'd have had the kind of peer group pressure we had and the kind of availability that we had, if they'd have said, no. I don't know. I've never known an alcoholic who wasn't a pig, so But there's some new terminology that's coming to Alcoholics Anonymous that I love. You know, drug of choice. I love drug of choice. My drug of choice is based on availability. I just simply didn't care where you had to shove it, stick it, swallow it, whatever you had to do with it, as long as I got to be dead. You know, I don't care. When I got sober, they explained to me that sobriety was clean and sober. I was real disappointed at that news. About 6 months before I got to the program, we had a vicious fight, and it was one of those kind of fights where you say all the stuff that you're never going to say to each other, and then I passed out. But I came to and realized that something awful had happened, and I started praying, and the prayer was, "Dear God, let this stop. Dear God, let this stop." And he arranged it quite nicely. About 6 months later, I was arrested by the West Hollywood Vice Squad on a sleazy little charge. I was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance from the front of my pants, from the waistband to the knees, soaked in my own urine. And it got my attention. And I went home, and I was alone. She was off saving somebody who didn't need to be saved in Orange County. And thank God for that. Thank God she wasn't there, because if she was there, she would have somehow made it okay. She would have turned it around that it was their fault or some horrible circumstance, but the fact is that nobody was there, and I had to deal with what was going on. And I had a series of revelations about myself that I know now are a spiritual experience. I didn't think they were then, but I saw that there was an enormous gap between who I was and who I wanted to be, and I couldn't figure out a way to bridge that gap. I couldn't figure any way to be the kind of person that I knew that I had been trained to be, that I had been taught to be, the kind of person that I wanted to be. I had spent so many years living outside of my own moral boundary, and I couldn't figure out how the hell to get back in, you know, to get close to what I believed in. And I realized that I had committed suicide of the soul, that my pilot light had gone out. But the most important revelation that night was that I realized that my life was over, and I was not going to die. And I never want to feel like that again as long as I live. And I said, "I wonder if I'm an alcoholic." That's the incredible thing about us drunks, is our unbelievable ability to overlook overwhelming evidence. And then I said, "I hope to God I am an alcoholic, because if I'm not, I'm hopelessly insane," because I had done everything that I could think of to avoid coming to this. I'd been to psychiatrists, I'd been to groups, I'd been to religions, I'd been to moral superiors, you know, I'd been to priests and Christian Brothers of Ireland, nuns and psychiatrists and social workers and sociologists gurus and poets and policemen and lawyers and judges. And I had explained to them my problem, and they had consulted their books and said, "This is what you should do about it." Well, if anybody says this is what you should do about your problem, I cut them off at the knees. But I had done everything that I could think of, and I thought, "If my God, if it's not alcoholism, there isn't any hope for me." So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous hoping to God that I belonged here and embarrassed that I did. There was a woman that I was working with, and I've been working with her for a year, and she had 6 years of sobriety. Her name was Suzanne, and I've been watching her for a year. And I believe that sobriety is the greatest gift that's ever been given to me, but I also believe it's the greatest responsibility that's ever been given to me, because if I'm going to be sober today, I'm going to be the best sober I can be, because I don't know who's watching me. And I watched Suzanne for a year. I watched how she lived her life. She had good days and she had bad days, but she was able to handle stuff that was just a little beyond me, and she had a sense of humor, and she made no bones about the fact that she was an alcoholic, and she was an Alcoholics Anonymous. And on April 24th, 1974, I said the last phrase. I took her aside, and I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I got 20 minutes before I go to pieces. And she heard the screaming. And she dropped everything, and she 12-stepped me. Now, we may have forgotten what 12-stepping is. 12-stepping is not driving somebody to a treatment center. That's being a cab driver. What a 12-step is when one drunk tells a story to another. And that's what she did. She bought me a sandwich. She took me to her apartment. She sat me down at her dining room table. He gave me something that I will never forget as long as I live. It was orange juice and Karo syrup. I can taste it to this day. She had the big book on her dining room table. She read chapter 5, chapter 3, and the 12 traditions, exactly what was read tonight. And I thought, my God, that woman is going to read that entire book to me. And then she told me her story. Now, my story was sleazy, but Suzanne's was disgusting. And the first miracle happened. I thought, my God, if she can stay sober, I can stay sober. And she looked across at me at the table and she said, Sean, in order for you to stay sober, you may have to lose everything. You may have to lose your wife and your house in the hills and your Mercedes and your spiffy wardrobe and your license. And you may have to lose it all in order to stay sober. Are you willing to do that? And I said, yes. And I don't know why I said yes, but I said yes. And I'm real grateful for that battery of questions, because I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with no conditions of my sobriety. I didn't come here to save a job. I didn't come here to save a marriage. I didn't come to save my standing in the community. I came here to save my ass. And I'm real, real grateful for that. I'm real grateful for that. I see so many people who come in from their employers or ultimatums from wives, you know. And then when it works out and it still doesn't fix them, a lot of them get drunk. You know? And she told me I had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and all that stuff. And I explained to her that alcohol was the problem, but I felt that I should kind of drift into sobriety on a little pink cloud of Valium. You know, that I should kind of touch down into it. You know, just kind of. And 17 years ago, she explained to me that they define sobriety in Southern California as clean and sober. And I said, what the hell does that mean? And she said, that means you don't drink and you don't take any self-administered mind-altering chemicals. Anything that will affect you from the neck up. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous stark, staring, sober. And the miracle is that from that day to this day, I have not had a drink or any self-administered mind-altering chemicals. One day at a time. And that's a miracle. That's a miracle. I met my sponsor the first night that I was sober, and he started to teach me the 12 steps, and I started learning them. And luckily, they didn't explain the 12 steps to me. They didn't explain the kind of sociological ramifications or how it was all going to work out. They just said, take them, kid, and don't ask any questions. There was a wonderful little guy who was... he was Otto Preminger's vocal coach. I don't know if any of you remember Otto Preminger, but he had such a German accent that you couldn't hear. Well, this guy had the worst German accent I'd ever heard. I guess he sounded perfect, Otto Preminger. I don't know what kind of vocal coaching he did, but he was in the program for a long, long time. And I talked to him one night about sobriety, and he said, don't analyze, utilize. And I never forgot it. I guess I just needed it to be said to me like that. Bonnie went to Al-Anon a week after I got sober. She was thrilled to find out that there was a place for her. And she went and she's been active ever since. Many of you here are in your first year of sobriety. But how do you like it so far? Right? It's the... one of the reasons that I stay sober, there are lots of reasons why I stay sober. My life is fabulous today. You know, I mean, even when it sucks, it's terrific. You know, but I... But one of the reasons that I stay sober is that I never want to have to get sober again as long as I live. Getting sober was the worst experience of my adult life. And if you're in your first year of sobriety, this is the last time you have to do this. You know? So hang in there. The wonderful thing about your first year of sobriety is the thing that keeps us out there so long, keeps us here in our first year. It's called denial. You know, I didn't realize how horrible my first year of sobriety was until I was about 3 years sober, and I looked back and went, yeah, it is utterly unsurvivable. But luckily I was so nuts. And I don't think that I could have gotten sober anywhere else but Southern California. It's just amazing, Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't realize how amazing it is until you go somewhere else, until you live somewhere else in the program. You know, most of us here are blissfully unaware of the resource we have of sobriety, the resource of the extravagant personalities. I mean, the incredible people, the wild stories from the podium. I mean, I loved going to meetings. I love going to meetings. It was not only sobriety, it was entertainment, it was society, it was everything. It was a festival every night, you know? Even when it was lousy, you know? And I went to my sponsor. I was 4 months sober, and I said, a couple of things happened to me when I was 4 months sober. I went to him and I said, I'm in real trouble. He said, what now? And I said, I identify with the women when they talk from the podium. And he said, that's because the women talk about their feelings. The men talk about events, and women talk about feelings, and that's what you're identifying with. And he said, if you're ever asked to share from a podium, which is highly unlikely, talk about your feelings, because that's what locks us together, and I try to do that. Also, when I was 4 months sober, I became impotent. The last thing that I did really well, you know, and I called my sponsor. Oh, he said, oh, hi, Sean, what's up? I said, nothing. I told him my problem. He said, it happens to most guys, 4 to 6 months sober. Don't worry, it'll go away. Anybody who's 4 to 6 months sober, it goes away. I said, but what about my wife? He said, she's probably relieved. When I was 6 months sober, I was crazier than I'd ever been in my entire life. I mean, just, you know, most psychiatrists, most professionals who know anything about alcoholism and have any ethics, which is a real rare combination, won't touch us with a barge pole in our first year of sobriety, because you can't double diagnose an alcoholic in his first year of sobriety, because we manifest every psychological disorder known to man. You know, when I was 6 months sober, I was clearly manic depressive. I mean, you know, I was either going, what? Or I was contemplating suicide. Yeah. And I was paranoid. I knew there were large groups of people talking about me in AA meetings. Yeah. Social psychopath, you know, I was suffering from acute shyness. As a matter of fact, that's one of my things as a human being that I don't know whether I'm over that or not. I'm a real shy human being. What I've done to overcompensate appalls me. But I'd really like to start another. I think what we need is another 12-step program. I really do. You know, I think 14,000 is not enough. You know, I think for shy people, SA we call it, and the meetings would be real quiet because everybody would be too afraid to say anything. It'd be real small because probably nobody would really show up because they'd be, But I would like it to be a psychological disorder. I would like it to be something out of my hands, you know, something that happened to me. But shyness in my case is simply extreme self-obsession. That's all it is. I am so concerned with the impression that I'm going to make on you that I don't do anything. You know, my shyness manifests itself in one of two ways. If I walk into a room like this, I will either go to a corner over there and read a magazine, or I'll stand in the center of the room and entertain you. Either way, I don't have to have a conversation with you. You know, but see, I can get two sentences out and that's it. I can say, hi, I'm Sean. How are you? And then I don't know what to say without a cocktail. And And 6 months sober, I literally could not talk to people. Other than if there was a topic at an AA meeting, I could babble about something, but I couldn't have a conversation. And I was going to meetings. I was working the 12 steps. I had taken my fourth and fifth step. I was doing my amends, and I was driving guys to meetings, and I was, talking to my sponsor every day and everything, and most afternoons you could see me driving up and down the Hollywood Freeway in a three-piece suit of my Mercedes, screaming at the top of my lungs because it was the only thing that would kill the pain. And the other thing that I tried to do through my entire first year of sobriety was sleep. A whole day of reality was more than I could handle, and if I wasn't going to get loaded, I was going to get out somehow. So I took a lot of naps. I could do that. I was a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife who worked, and so I was in sales. And so I took a lot of afternoons off, and I had my first spiritual experience when I was 6 months sober, and it didn't feel like one at the time, but it turned out that it was actually one. And what it was, I was trying to take a nap, and I couldn't. And I was just furious, and I looked up at the ceiling, and I said, "I don't believe in you, and I think you're a jerk!" And then it occurred to me, if I didn't believe, who was I yelling at? And then being a good ex-Catholic, I waited for 3 weeks to see if I was going to get punished for calling him a jerk. And I didn't, because I'd had this real peculiar relationship with God. I had been raised an Irish Catholic as opposed to a Roman Catholic. And I, my wife is a Polish Catholic, and she says there is a difference. And I had been an altar boy, and by the time I was 23 years old, I'd broken every one of the Ten Commandments, and that's a biggie for a former altar boy. And so, since I couldn't practice my religion, I didn't have a God. That was so smart, I threw the baby out with the bathwater. And what I did was my spiritual life, that's when I became spiritually lost, really. That's when my alcoholism took a nosedive, and a lot of stuff happened behind that. And I kind of parked God like an old Plymouth, and whenever I was in trouble, I'd go find it, And I learned those two alcoholic prayers. They're hard to do now. The first one is, "Dear God, get me out of this and I will never do it again." And the second alcoholic prayer is, "Phew." If you're new, if you're in your first year, I got some real bad news for you. Besides the fact that it's clean and sober, the other bad news is that there's no spiritual side to the program. The whole thing is a spiritual program. There's no side to it. These are spiritual principles that we live by. They're not unique spiritual principles. The 12 steps are principles that are in the Muslim religion, in Buddhism, in Judaism, in Protestantism, Catholicism, and everything. I mean, the nuns taught me exactly the same stuff, I just couldn't hear it from them. I couldn't hear it from anybody until I got here. Because you said the magic phrase to me. You said, "I know how you feel." And as soon as somebody says, "I know how you feel," then I can listen to them. That has nothing to do with all those. There's nothing wrong with the people who try to teach me. There's something to do with that's wrong with me. I can't hear it unless you say, "I know how you feel." So that afternoon started a spiritual odyssey with me. I'd been doing it. My sponsor had told me that I had to search for God on a daily basis, that I'd probably never find God, but I had to search on a daily basis, and he explained to me how I had to do it, and it was real embarrassing. I had to do it on my knees, and because he said that I was one of the arrogant ones. I thought that hurt my feelings, So he showed me how to do it, and God, it was awful. And I did it because, I did it. I would get up in the morning, I'd go in the bathroom, and I'd lock the door, and I'd get down on my knees, and I'd say, "Okay, God, keep me sober, and let me know what you want me to do today." And then I would get up, look around, unlock the door, and walk out real cool, And then at night, I would go and lock the bathroom door and get down on my knees and say, "Thank you, God, for keeping me sober." And then I'd get up and look around, unlock the bathroom door, and walk out. I left the bathroom door open when I puked, but I locked it when I prayed. Yeah. And nothing happened. I mean, it just embarrassed me. But that day that I yelled at God, a thing broke in me, an idea of a God that was out there and up there. And what started to form was the idea that perhaps I was carrying around a little microchip of God within me. That maybe there was something going on within me. It's what the nuns called the soul, but I couldn't hear it. And I started listening at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in a different way. I'd been raised in a tradition that if it wasn't Lourdes, it wasn't a miracle. And I started listening to people in Alcoholics Anonymous talking about making quantum leaps as human beings. They were impossible. You know, getting jobs and families being repaired and returning to society and becoming functional human beings. Something that were beyond our will to do. Things that were happening in their lives. And I would grab them as miracles and kind of stuff them in my pockets like a squirrel gathering nuts to kind of shore up this kind of very shaky non-belief in God. And I found God in Alcoholics Anonymous through your irreverence. You know, people used to say the most amazing thing about God in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. You know, I kept waiting for them, you know, to get struck by lightning in those places, the stuff that we were talking about. And slowly but surely, I came to believe that it was possible to have some kind of relationship. When I was 5 years sober, I was... You know, things got good and bad and different and all the stuff that happens in sobriety. And I kept working the steps and working with my sponsor. And I got to 5 years sober, and I got to be very sober. I got to be, as only somebody with 5 years of sobriety can be, you know, very importantly sober. I mean, I had a significant program. You could almost taste it when you were around me. And I had reached that plateau of 5 years when I understood the principles and that I could pass it on to those who needed it, the still suffering alcoholic. And some of the old-timers, I noticed, were still suffering. And while my sobriety was taking on a glow, I proceeded to explore some very, very old ideas because I was real sober. And I didn't know what was going on with me, but I wanted to find out what the fence lines of my sobriety were. What I was trying to find out was just how much rope I had before I'd hang myself. And I started looking into some stuff that I hadn't done in a long time. And when I was 5.5 years sober, I was arrested one more time by the West Hollywood Vice Squad. I was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance. It ain't as much fun sober. And I had to come to grips with what was going on with me. It was a Tuesday night, and Bonnie was at her Al-Anon meeting, and she came home and walked into the kitchen and said, "My God, what's happening?" And I told her what had happened. And the miracle of Al-Anon had happened to her. Because she didn't scream, and she didn't cry. And she didn't say, "What are you doing to our marriage? What are you doing to our lives? Why are you doing this to me?" Instead, she sat down across the table, and she reached across, and she put her hand on my face, and she said, "Oh, Sean, I'm so sorry you got to hurt yourself so much." She said, "I don't understand your needs, but I do understand mine. And I need you to be loyal and supportive. And if you can be that, I'll continue to be your wife because I love you. If you can't be that, I can't continue to be your wife because I love you." And I had to look at myself, and I had to look at what I wanted and who I was. And 2 weeks later, after a lot of talk and a lot of writing and all that kind of stuff, I took my wedding vows again, and we started to rebuild our marriage and deal with some stuff that needed to be dealt with. And in my 7th year of sobriety, we decided that fear of change was no longer a reason not to have children, and so we started playing a little Vatican roulette. And bingo. It was also about that time that I underwrote a loan to my sponsor using my house as collateral. It was a rather substantial sum. And I did a very foolish thing. I did it without talking to somebody with more sobriety about it. And he defaulted on the loan. And I suddenly was broke, real broke. I had to put the house on the market. It was a tough time for us. When I was 8 years sober, my daughter was born, and I got to cut her umbilical cord and give her her first bath. And it was a miraculous time for me, a wonderful time for me. Now, you have beautiful and intelligent children, but I have Kate. And she's an incredible kid. But we were stuck with a real interesting financial crisis, because what had happened was Bonnie had worked until she was 9 months pregnant, and then she quit work at the job she was at, she quit work on a Saturday, and I went to work on a Monday and came home at 11 o'clock in the morning, and Bonnie said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "My company went bankrupt, we had no money, and the baby was due." And I said, "Okay, God, I don't know how you're going to work this out, but I'm real interested." And I didn't realize that a miracle had happened within me because I wasn't angry. I wasn't angry. I was just real interested in how it was going to work out. So we decided to put the house on the market. We had to refinance, and we couldn't refinance because I didn't have a job. And so we had to put the house up for sale, and nobody bought it. And we were scrambling. It was a tough time. I applied to 6 banks, and they turned me down, and the house sat on the market for 6 months with nobody buying the thing. And about 6 months into it, Bonnie said, "Why don't we go back to our regular bank and see what's happening?" So we did. I went back, and I said, "I'd like to see the loan officer, please." And they said, "Okay, there's a new loan officer here." And I went over, and there was a woman named Eloise, and Eloise was enormous. She was this huge lady. We sat down and explained our problem. She said, "Well, you've been working for 6 months and you've been with this bank for a long time." She said, "I think we can do this." And so they refinanced the house and we got out of the problem. Three weeks later, Bonnie went into the bank and said, "Oh, she'd like to say hello to Eloise." And they said, "Oh, I'm sorry, she's no longer with the bank. She's been transferred to another branch." When she told me that, we decided that God got dressed up and dragged so that we could get out of the problem. But I had a real problem with my sponsor because I realized that he had a program that did not have a seventh tradition in it, and yet he was the man that had taught me everything that I believed. The human being that I am today, what I believe and my sobriety was taught to me by that man, and I didn't know what to do. And I felt disloyal, and I just didn't know what to do. And one of my the guys that I sponsored said we should write. And since I sponsored him, I couldn't admit that I was too afraid to do that. So we did, and we wrote a series of synopses for screenplays and all that kind of thing. And it developed into a business with my younger brother, in Canada. Eventually, the guy that I sponsored dropped out of the project, and I went on with it, and the business started to evolve in Vancouver, and we moved to Vancouver three years ago. But before that happened, I had been asked to, when I was 10 years sober, I had been asked to speak in Hawaii. The regular speaker bombed out, so they called me and said, "Gee, we need a substitute," and I said, "Oh, all right." It's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. Hawaii, God. I was one of those guys that was too hip to go to Hawaii, you know. So I went to work the next day. I said, "Gee, I've been asked to go to Hawaii." And a guy that I worked with said, "Gee, my mother has a condominium and she's never there. You can use it for a week if you want for free. I don't care, you know." He said, "I'm not sure where it is." And it turned out to be 500 yards away from the conference. And a check, we were dead broke, and a check came in the mail that was from a residual for an acting job that I'd done 1,000 years ago. It was exactly the amount for a round-trip ticket. So Bonnie could go. And Kate was to travel the day before she was 2 years old so she could travel for free. So we went to Hawaii. And on her second birthday, it was her second birthday. And on her little birthday, Bonnie was kind of doing a thing in the condo, you know, a little birthday thing. And I took Kate down to the beach. And I was standing on a beach in Hawaii, this deserted beach that was just miles of white sand in either direction, but not a soul on them. The palm trees drooping over and this turquoise water lapping in, and my little 2-year-old running in and out of the water, squealing and laughing like little 2-year-olds would be. And she has red hair, and it was exactly the same color as the sunset. And I realized I was standing in the middle of a dream. They tell you when you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't make any plans, because your plans will just be hemmed in by your own fear. You know, if you just let go and let God, stuff happens to us that are beyond anything that we could dream of. And I realized that picture that I was standing in, that I couldn't have conceived of this scene when I got sober. And that even if I could have conceived of that scene, I wouldn't dare to have dreamed it, because it would have been pushing God's goodwill just too far. But something else happened that day that I wasn't aware of until years later. Because what happened that day was that I realized something about my relationship to my daughter. I'm a man with a very, very limited ability to love. There's something that's always been cold in the center of me. Some people just kind of love naturally. It's been hard work for me. It's been a skill that I just have had to work desperately on. And I think what's happened over the little while that I've been with you is that you've taught me some techniques and some things, and I believe now that I have a capacity to do it. Now, I don't love Kate because she's perfect. I love Kate because she's mine. And if somebody with the limited ability that I have is capable of feeling that for a child, and if the premise is that I'm one of God's children, I wonder what God's capable of. Somebody who is capable of infinite love, I wonder what God feels about me. I believe that the way we treat our children is the way we believe in God. And the way I treat Kate is I try to point out her choices, and I try to share my experience and guide her to the best of my ability, and let her make her choices and not protect her from her consequences. And I think that's what God does for me. I don't think that God cares whether I'm drunk or sober. And I don't think God cares whether I'm good or bad. I just think God cares. I think that's God's job description. I don't believe there are any good people or bad people anymore. I just think there are people who know and people who don't know. And I spent my life being one of the people who didn't know. And I have a hunger to know. I've had a hunger to know since I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And you've taught me stuff. The 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the 12 concepts. Try and learn the 12 concepts. There's a daunting feat. I moved to Vancouver, British Columbia, and it was difficult for me. I didn't realize what a support group, what a bunch of people I had here, and I moved up there, and they do it differently there, and luckily when we left, Bob, who is the Al-Anon delegate, told Bonnie that there's a meeting, an Al-Anon meeting, I believe it is, in Chicago, that's called the We Don't Care How You Do It in Southern California group. and it was something for me to really hold in my mind when I go other places, because they don't really care how we do it in Southern California. And so what I realized when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't change for me. I changed for Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the way it is in Vancouver. They're kind of coming around, and I'm more comfortable. And I got up there and I didn't know what to do, so I got a cleanup commitment, and I washed floors a lot, and I feel okay, and I got some guys that I sponsor and some guys that I care about, and I've got a life that a guy like me doesn't deserve to have. I got a family, and I'm a member of a community, and I'm an active participant in life, and I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to restore us to some kind of normal life, that we become functional human beings. You know, I believe that the most important 12-step work that I can do is that when you tell somebody you're an alcoholic, they don't believe it. And I think that's terrific. I think that's when we're most effective. And I do that kind of work. I've always been active in service. The first night that I was sober, my sponsor told me to empty the ashtray and fold up the chair, and I've been doing stuff like that ever since. One of the first jobs that I had in Alcoholics Anonymous was shaking hands at Wilshire, Normandy. I would have rather faced a firing squad than stood at the door and shook hands. I hated it. I absolutely hated it. It was terrifying to me. And I did it because I was told you couldn't say no to an AA request. And I would stand there every day, every Sunday night with my sweaty palms and shake hands. And I just hated it. But I realized that it was an act of love. And luckily they didn't tell me that. They just told me to do it. And I told you I'm kind of shy. I got to speak a lot in Southern California, and if you recognize my car, I would drive into the meeting and I'd sit in the parking lot and I'd be sitting in my car for a couple of minutes, and you'd think, isn't that wonderful? Sean's getting his spiritual message together. And what I was doing, I was sitting in my car saying, you got to get out of this car, Sean. You know, they've seen you. You can't drive out now. You know. And so I would get out of my car and I would walk to the... I walked to the door and I'd see that wall of people, you know, and then some poor guy whose sponsor made him do it would stick his hand out of the door and say, "Hi, I'm Fred," and he would stick out his hand and he would pull me through the door, and he didn't know that he was doing that. But that's what we do for each other, you know. That's an act of love, you know. the wonderful thing about us, when they talk about us being made in the image of God, I believe it's not the way we look. I think it's the way we act. I think when we're being loving is when we most look like God. And I can see that in AA meetings. I can see the family resemblance. You know, when some little old lady tells some 15-year-old punker girl, you know, who's got a safety pin stuck through her nose, come and sit next to me, honey. You know? Then I can see the family resemblance. When somebody gets to the meeting at 6:30 at night and puts on the coffee, I can see the family resemblance. When some guy takes the bus all the way down to central office to buy the literature and takes the bus back, I can see the family resemblance. You know, when some guy's standing in the Safeway trying to figure out what cookies to buy for the meeting, I can see the family resemblance. You notice that? Sometimes you come down the aisle in the Safeway and there's a guy standing there in front of the cookies like that. You know, and I figure he's either loaded or he's a cookie chairman. You know, And I just go by and say chocolate chip, and he says, "Oh, thanks, man." You know? Yeah. But I can see the family resemblance. I think we're extraordinary people. I think we're extraordinary people because we've come from so terrible a place. Self-imposed hell, you know. And we don't drink one day at a time, and we'll work the steps to the best of our ability one day at a time, and we'll be of service one day at a time, and things change and things get better, and it takes a long time. It takes a long time. You know, in the time that I've been sober, I've seen a lot of people go to psychiatrists and groups and other programs and all kinds of stuff, and you know what? They've been sober the same time as I have, and they're no further along than I am. You know, this 12 steps is perfectly designed for alcoholics. When they finished the 12 steps, he sent it off to Carl Jung, who was the first one who identified alcoholism and the hopelessness of the disease, that nothing could be done with it. And he read the 12 steps and he wrote back to Bill Wilson and said, "This is a perfect therapy for alcoholics." And I believe that. I believe that. And I see people in Alcoholics Anonymous today who don't believe that. They don't believe that this thing quite works. They think they got to have add-ons and appurtenances. And I've got to tell you, it works. It works. I came here, I was shattered, and you glued me back together. You pasted me back together. And in some of the places where you pasted me, I'm stronger. And in some of the places where you pasted me back together, I'm weaker. And I don't always know which is which. So I keep coming back to tell you what's going on with my life, and you say, "I know how you feel," and then you tell me your experience, and it gets better for me. And I love it, and I love you. So I want you to keep coming back. God bless you.